The talk is called Saluting the Sangha, and that's because what we're going to look at is the Sangha section of the Salutation to the Three Jewels, which is what we were reciting downstairs, the Ti Ratana Vandana. So Vandana means a salutation or a paying of respect, and Ti Ratana is the Pali for the Three Jewels. So we're called the Tri Ratna community here. So just to confuse things a little bit, a number of languages are used in Buddhism, sometimes Sanskrit, sometimes Pali. Tri Ratna is Sanskrit, which is a more widespread language in Buddhism. Ti Ratana is the same in Pali, and it means the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. So the text of the salutation, which goes back to very, very early Buddhism, we're not quite sure where, but probably the lifetime of the Buddha, is something to recite, which is a description of the qualities of each of the three jewels and an expression of going for refuge to each of the three jewels. So we'll come on to that. And I'm not going to go through the whole thing. I'm not going to go through the Buddha section and the Dharma section, which are very interesting in themselves. But the translation is there on the back of your sheet. I'm just going to go through the Sangha section. And I thought that would be a nice way to look at what the Sangha is about. Particularly just to see, well, what did the very early Buddhists, presumably the Buddha himself, what was their idea of Sangha and the qualities of Sangha? And in a way, this seems to have been the Buddha's own habit, and the habit of early Buddhism was to do a lot of appreciating. Appreciation and rejoicing was quite a big part of their practice. It happened on an individual level, where the Buddha himself and many others would simply spend a bit of time just rejoicing in the qualities of a person. They'd say they're particularly good at this, this and this. He even actually did this in a systematic way at one point, where he went through by name many of his men and women disciples, both monks and lay people, and said they're particularly good at such and such. You know. So this thing of appreciation is a very common feature in early Buddhism. And in particular, the Buddha actually quite often expressed appreciation for the Sangha, for the community of those who were trying to practice. And in a way, this is what this is, but it's a specific appreciation. It's not just, I mean, the gushy sort of appreciation is quite nice, where you say to somebody, oh, you're so wonderful, you'll make my favourite person of all time. But what the Buddha tended to do, and what he does here, is to be quite specific. So what is it about the Sangha exactly which is so good? And I think that's quite helpful on a personal level as well, when you're appreciating somebody personally. You know, if you say, well, The ability you've got to listen, I really, really appreciate that. That's very, very useful. And so that you're being a bit more specific than just saying you're absolutely wonderful, which is nice in itself. I'm not saying don't do that. You know, but, so, yes, I think the feeling I have from reciting something, like with the refuge and precepts, that's been there as part of the Buddhist tradition right from very close to the very beginning is almost gives me a little shudder, goes through me when I think that those words, or something maybe with a slightly different accent, but pretty much the same words, were being uttered by many, many millions of Buddhists, especially in the Indian Buddhist world and the South Asian Buddhist world, where, and Southeast Asian Buddhist world, where the Pali language is used in those schools. So I'm just going to read out the English translation. This is a little bit different from the translation on the back of here, and I'll explain probably later why I've chosen slightly different terms sometimes. Obviously, when you're translating something, you know, there's always different possibilities. Happily proceeding is the Sangha of hearers of the richly endowed one. Uprightly proceeding is the Sangha of hearers of the richly endowed one. I think I'll say straight away that the richly endowed one means the Buddha. It's a word for the Buddha. Methodically proceeding is the Sangha of hearers of the richly endowed one. Harmoniously proceeding is the Sangha of hearers of the richly endowed one. Namely, these eight persons, these four pairs of individuals. This Sangha of hearers of the richly endowed one is worthy of worship, worthy of offerings, worthy of hospitality, worthy of salutation with folded hands, an unexcelled source of goodness or field of merit for the world. To all the Sanghas of the past, to all the Sanghas yet to be, to all the Sanghas that now are, my worship flows unceasingly, No other refuge than the Sangha. Refuge supreme is there for me. Oh, by virtue of this truth, may auspiciousness and victory come to me. So that's it. And it's quite short, isn't it? You think I'd probably get that out of the way quite quickly. But the amazing thing about Buddhist texts in general is that very often each word is pregnant with a lot of meaning. And so actually it's going to be quite difficult for me within an hour or so to really do justice to some of the concepts, some of the ways of appreciating the Sangha that are there in the Tiratnavanda. But let's see how we go anyway. But I think because there are not many here, if you want to chip in at any point for clarification, please do feel free to do that. So, what is the Sangha? I mean, we know this, but I'll just remind you. The Sangha is the network or community of those who follow the Dharma to achieve Buddhahood. So that's the way the three jewels connect together. The Sangha is the network or community of those who follow the Dharma to achieve Buddhahood. And so those three jewels on the kesa are a reminder of that. The blue one for the Dharma, the golden or yellow one for the Buddha, and the red one for the Sangha. And you may have noticed downstairs that red, in fact some people here are in red as well, red is the dominant colour of the Sangha. Why is the Sangha saluted and revered in this way? So that it may be quite obvious for the Buddha and the Dharma. The Buddha is the goal of awakening. The Dharma is everything that helps you move towards awakening, become more awake, if you like. So it's obvious why they should be revered. But why just the bunch of people who happen to be doing it? You know, why do they matter? Why do they give an equal significance to the other two? And I think that's what these words help us to see. But before I go into it, I just want to mention three levels or three meanings of the word Sangha. So these are the great Sangha, the Sangha of the ordained, I just call it the ordained Sangha for short, and the noble Sangha. I won't give you the Pali Sanskrit words for these. In fact, I won't do that in general unless you ask, or unless there's something particular to say about the word. But the great Sangha means the whole assembly of all those who feel a connection with the Buddha at all sorts of levels, you know. So people who make use of the Buddha's teachings, people who are in some kind of contact with each other. And what we could say, although maybe even this is too specific, but we could say, you know, everyone who regards themselves as a Buddhist or a follower of the Buddha is the great Sangha. It's us. We are part of the great Sangha. Everybody who's inspired by enlightened people and their teachings. And you could even make it wider than that and say that it's everybody who is striving for skillful mental states and who are in touch with each other. So in a way, you know, if you wanted to, you could include people who didn't think of themselves as Buddhists within the Mahasangha. So it's a network. And it's a network, in fact, the way that Sangharaksha has talked about it is a free association of individuals, ideally. So it's a network, but not a codependent network, not a network of people who they're trying at least to be independently practicing people, but yet they're in touch with each other. And then we've got the Sangha, the ordained Sangha, or Sanghas, it might be better to say here, because of course there are many ordination lineages and many orders in Buddhism. In the southern Buddhist countries, generally this means monks or nuns. But in Buddhism as a whole, it's not necessarily that, and of course in our order, the Triratna order, it's not neither monastic nor lay. So the ordained Sanghas are those that have made an explicit public commitment to the three jewels being at the centre of their lives for the whole of their life. So in a way, that's which is in a way, I would say at least, is summing up the ordination. It's something where it's not just feeling a general connection, it's actually having decided to make that commitment and make it in the context of a particular existing order as well. So there may be people, of course, who are very, very committed to practicing, but they haven't yet found, may never find, an order that really suits what they need. So this is not an evaluative thing. It's not that the ordained Sangha are necessarily more committed than members of the Mahasangha, but what they have done, they've explicitly joined a particular order. And then the noble Sangha. And the noble Sangha means all of those with some genuine degree of realization, to use that word, or insight, if you like. And this is when it comes later on to the eight persons, the four pairs of individuals. That's what it refers to, different types of people within the noble Sangha. So the noble Sangha is particularly an object of respect and reverence, because that's all those people. It doesn't necessarily mean teachers, because I'm not a member of the Arya Sangha, and I'm actually doing things that look a bit like teaching. So it is people that, in a way, you have a lot of respect for. Maybe people you've encountered through your reading or through biographies, that kind of thing. Maybe the Buddha himself, the great famous teachers of Zen and so on, maybe there. Anonymous people as well. You know there are many of these people around who've attained some degree of, let's say, really well-established realization. Because I suppose we've all attained some degree of realization, but something that is well-established that they will not lose, which is called in early Buddhism is known as entering the stream to enlightenment. So they're now in the current that will take them to enlightenment sooner or later. So that's the Arya Sangha. Yes, you find them in the images. So it would include mythical beings would be regarded as being members of the Arya Sangha, the Bodhisattva of wisdom here, or the Bodhisattva of purity up here, the white Bodhisattva, Vajrasattva, and so on. So you don't know, in a way, who these people are. You can't really assume that people are to some extent enlightened, but you can't assume that they aren't either. You know, so it's a little bit of a mystery, this, but it's nice to have the sense that there are such people around and that have been throughout Buddhist tradition, people that have got this very deep degree of realization. And maybe what we can do is be as open as we can to each other, because that's what we're offering, possibly offering each other as we meet each other. So the Tiratanavandana, strictly speaking, is concerning the noble Sangha, because only the noble Sangha is regarded as a fit refuge, in the sense that because they've got this degree of transcendental realization, it means that they are, at least to some extent, likely to be reliable. You're, in a way, you're accessing some sort of deep insight, rather than just accessing somebody's just opinion or their personality or whatever. There's something there that goes beyond their ego, goes beyond themselves, that you're accessing. So strictly speaking, you go for refuge to the Arya Sangha and not to the Sangha in general.
You don't know who they are, so
that's right.
Ideal, yes.
In a sense, it's you go for refuge to an ideal, yes. But you probably do have people that you place within your Arya Sangha. And it doesn't matter if there's somebody you put up there who, it turns out, later isn't. Because going for refuge, in a way, going for refuge is always a provisional thing, I think. So, you know, unless it's something, you know, absolute and sure, then you can always change your mind about it, can't you? So the same goes for the Dharma. You know, the Dharma that you go for refuge to is those teachings which are genuinely reliable. But how do you know which teachings are genuinely reliable? You've got a sense, at least, that some of them are. And so you can go for refuge to the Dharma. But the same goes for the Sangha, and maybe even the Buddha as well.
So I always understood that going for refuge as applying to the ordained Sangha, because at least there you may be talking about personalities and qualities that are not reliable, but then there's kind of safety in numbers.
Well, that's not the tradition, certainly not in the Pali tradition. No, the refuge is for the Arya Sangha. And of course, the thing about this is that even during the Buddha's lifetime, there were clearly many people who were not ordained not members of an order, but they were recognized as being in the Arya Sangha. So in the Buddha's life, at least judging by the Pali Canon, they defined the ordained as being those who were monks and nuns. As I say, that isn't the case in other Buddhist schools, but in early Buddhism, monks and nuns were the ordained. But there were many lay men and lay women who had reached strong degrees of transcendental realization. And they were teaching as well. That's important. They weren't just anonymous. They were also involved in teaching. So I think certainly in early Buddhism, that wouldn't have been the view. The view was... And I think that you've got to be a little bit suspicious because, of course, it's in the interests of people like me or Yashobodhi to start sort of puffing ourselves up and saying we're the people you should have true respect for because we've got the kesa, we're ordained. But I think you should be very suspicious of any order member that starts trying to do that to you, any member of the ordained sangha.
So you'll be hung by your own kesa, wouldn't you?
Yes, I think so, yes. And that's why I think the sense of being a little bit vague about who the Sangha is you go for refuge to is actually quite good. You know, it may be for a while, there may be a particular person you have huge admiration for. It could be, you know, somebody in our order. It could be, you know, the Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh or a historical figure, a dead figure like Nagarjuna or a Ratisha or a Milarepa. Now, then you might later find out something about it and you think, oh, I'm not so sure about that. You know, it says he got drunk. What's that about? You know, I'm not so sure about it anymore. So you don't have that hard and fast sense, but at least you have a sense that there is an Arya Sangha around.
Milarepa, I can't get over that he was a mass murderer.
Well, there you go, yes, yes. But that was, of course, long before his enlightenment. One should make, in case anyone doesn't know that, that's pretty clear. But still,
yeah. That doesn't
work
it out.
Yeah, yes. No. But I feel, though, that this business of going for refuge, or at least this business of the respect, of showing respect, is, in a sense, rather than narrowing it down too much, we should, in a way, widen it out. And the respect, and even in a sense, in a very general sense, the refuge, but certainly the respect, we should have for each other. This is our Sangha. It's the people we meet. It's the people we're practicing with. And I think that we're all flawed, we've all got problems, but I think that intense respect we should have for each other. And I think that I would like to apply the words that Thich Nhat Hanh found in it to us and see how that works out. Remembering in the background that it was originally intended particularly for the noble sangha, but I think all the words actually I think are relevant for us, or most of them anyway. So in a way you can regard others in the sangha as if they are Arya, as if they are noble. You can recognize their nobility. You can speak to that. And if you do that, it'll grow. It'll be encouraged. Respect for each other. Looking for the finest qualities in each other, I think. In the same way I talked about at the beginning, about that intense appreciation that was there in early Buddhism for people. Acknowledging, expressing happiness in those qualities and their actions. And I think that by doing that, that sort of appreciation, that acknowledgement of our good qualities is what turns a group of people into a sangha. It's as if we relate on the level of our finest, if you like. That's what we try and do. And what about oneself as well? It may be that one feels that one isn't worthy to belong to the sangha in that general sense. But I think that's a mistake. But sometimes one can feel a bit left out. Maybe here at the centre you can feel that others have the confidence and that, you know, that you're unusual, you're different in that way. So I think that a good way to respond if you do lack confidence in that way is to start giving confidence to other people. Realise that the other people are in the same boat. They also feel maybe a little bit unworthy or a bit small or a bit lost or a bit neglected or whatever. And we go out to each other and recognise that that will exist in a lot of people, actually. Then again, we'll be creating Sangha. Because Sangha is something that you create. It's not something that you join. It's something that is constantly being recreated. Network of people rather than being some closed circle that you may or may not be let into. It's porous at the edge. I think that's very important. So in a way you're creating a purified world by relating to each other at our best, if you like. Okay, so if we start off the Tiratnavanda, it talks about the hearers of the richly endowed one. The hearers of the richly endowed one. So the Sangha in the early days was said to be those who had a receptivity to the Buddha. They had gathered around the Buddha and were receptive to him in some way. So that's why they were known as the hearers. And I think this is quite an interesting way of putting it. The Sangha is those who listen. They listen out for reality, they listen out for the Dharma, they listen out for the voice of the Buddha. And when by listening, of course, they hear it. I think it's interesting the difference between the visual sense and the hearing sense. That to look, you actually have to sort of turn your gaze and open your eyes. But listening is the other way around. You have to actively stop yourself from hearing something. So it's that lovely open sense that is open to things coming from all directions. It does, that's right. In fact, that's true in traditional Buddhism as well. So you have the first level of wisdom is the wisdom of hearing, of taking in, isn't it? So the hearers are those that understand. Yes, I agree with that. So you're building a receptivity, but here it's specifically a receptivity to the richly endowed one. I will give you the word here because it's Bhagavan is the word, which became much more widely used in India after the time of the Buddha. But originally it was... it literally has a meaning of abundance, and particularly it's recognizing somebody with an abundance of fine qualities. And it was one of the words most commonly used for the Buddha, maybe even more commonly than the word Buddha. So here translated the richly endowed one, or the abundant one, sometimes the blessed one, but that has a slightly saintly sort of feel to it for me. I'm not so sure about that. But so the richly endowed one. So the Sangha of hearers of the richly endowed one. And then there's a series of words describing this Sangha of hearers of the richly endowed one. And the first one is happily proceeding. So the Sangha don't just hear, they also proceed. So all of these ones are to do with proceeding. And it makes me think of, you know, life as a journey, or life as a pilgrimage, or life at least as a series of footsteps, as if you're moving, you're actually going somewhere in a way, metaphorically speaking. And I think that's very interesting. You're walking along a path, but you're doing it in company. That's the thing about the Sangha. And happily, you can also translate it as just positively, with positivity. And in fact, one of the local... rulers at the time of the Buddha, he was very interested in religion at the time, and a very keen observer. He was always making comments about the different religions and the different religious people at the time. And he said he felt the Buddha Sangha was characterized by being joyous and joyful, exultant and jubilant, buoyant and fervent, without care or worry, tranquil, with purpose become, as creatures of the wild. Which is quite interesting, isn't it, that little series of description. That was his at least impression. I'm sure they weren't always like that. I mean, you can't always be very, very tranquil and happy and all that kind of thing. But that's the dominant impression that he got. And then as creatures of the wild, almost as if he saw them as being just sort of playing around like deer in the forest, or like little rabbits or something like that. I'm not quite sure what kind of creatures he was thinking of. But anyway, that was his impression of them, that joyousness. And in fact, the Dhammapada says, happy is the appearance of enlightened people. Happy is the teaching of the sublime Dharma. Happy is the unity of the Sangha. And happy is the spiritual practice of the united ones. So that happiness is a very important aspect. And as I say, it's not that you ought to be happy and ought to pretend to be happy. It's more that I think it's good to look for a path which is a path that contains joy. In other words, it's one of the features, one, in a way, is a sign that you're starting on the right path. It's not that everything's always going to be wonderful. It's not that you won't have suffering and difficulty and obstacles and even misery and despair at times, maybe. But yet you're looking for a path that contains joy. Happily or positively proceeding is the Sangha of hearers of the richly endowed one. It's the goal and it's also the flavour of the means. But it should be the atmosphere of the Sangha, I think, ideally. So happily proceeding together. You know, in a way, being as far as we can be, reasonably happy with each other, with all our flaws. And the way do you, how do you do that? And it's very, very simple to say how you do it. It's very difficult to do it. But you find skillful happiness and then you operate from it. So the happiness here is not just any gratification. There are some ways in which you may actually feel, as it were, satisfied by something, but it may not necessarily be skillful. So you need to work out what kinds of happiness are skillful. And then once you find that, you operate from that skillful happiness. And then it will tend to very gradually grow stronger and become more of a resource. So it's what you give attention to that becomes stronger. So if you do have despondency and you give it a lot of attention, it will tend to grow. It'll tend to become a bigger part of your mind and of your world, in a way. So you try and transfer your attention to that skillful happiness. That's a bit brief, I know. We can talk more about that later, maybe. Acknowledge that, you know, acknowledge what's happening, like the despondency, but then see if you can look deeper, look below it. And happiness comes from being really engaged, being energized by what you're doing. So that's one word, happily proceeding. Now the next word is uprightly proceeding, or straightly proceeding. That's what it means. And it has a strong sense of being straightforward with each other in the Sangha, no playing of games, and also of practicing ethics, of being ethical. So the Sangha is characterized by attempting to be as ethical, as skillful as possible. It's a network of people where skillfulness is mutually encouraged. And I think this is really important, to be upright, to be reliable, to be ethical. To feel completely free to talk over one's life, at least with some few trusted people, if at all possible. Others in the Sangha. So it means that if you have been unskillful, if you've done something that you really regret, you try to develop enough trust to tell other people about it. And hopefully to have confidence that it will be heard, that it won't be brushed aside, that you won't be dismissed because of it, but it'll be taken seriously, what you have to say. So that's wonderful if you can get that. And how do you do that? How do you build up trust? You build up trust by being as trustworthy as you possibly can be yourself. Because that's all you can do. You can't force it of others, but at least you can try and bring it, make it stronger in yourself. Straight also says something about the way you proceed, not going down all the bypaths. Not that you want to be narrow, not to have a narrow path. It's actually a broad path. There's a Zen saying that the great way is broad and plain for all to see. The great way is broad and plain for all to see. But people love the bypaths. And I suppose that's certainly true of me, that you find all sorts of other things that start to engage your attention, and it can take quite a long while before you realise that it's taken you off the basic broad path towards greater skillfulness, greater concentration, greater wisdom. And they may be positive activities, but I just think it's worth just seeing whether they've become your main path. So, be positive, be upright. Those are the first two words. But this is not enough, because the next one is methodically proceeding. And I think that the first two, in a way, are very, you know, obviously nobody's going to object to them, I should imagine. It's very valuable to be as positive and happy as you can in your process. It's very valuable to be upright and straight in your process. But methodical is a little bit more difficult. And sometimes we don't really want to be methodical. We'd rather be quite chaotic, which maybe is fine for a while. So it's not enough to have a general idea of being spiritual. Somebody truly in the Sangha is growing in a way step by step, stage by stage, trying to work out where you are now and what you need for now, rather than leaping ahead. Always being prepared to take that next step, even if it's quite frightening. And I think sometimes it is a bit a bit scary. You can see this is what I would like to do next, but that is a little bit scary, you know. Which is okay, again, you know, there's plenty of time, but it's good just to keep that in view and say, well, it does look to me like that is the next step, even though I'm a bit scared about it. Find out where you are, find out how to proceed. And I think that part of this is to have a real area of work right now. So you do have a conscious sense, I should say I'm very bad at this myself, but to have a conscious sense of what area of life you feel is most relevant to be working on at the moment. That's being methodical about it, not hopping about into all sorts of things, but saying, okay, look, this is something I'd really like to devote myself to for a while, and let's find the best way of doing that. And doing it with others, if possible, as well. That's why you need the Sangha here, I think, so that you're not on your own doing this. It's very difficult in isolation to tell what the next area of work is, and it's another really good way, just talk it over with people that you trust and who know you well. You might say, well, I suspect I need to change my job, or I suspect I need to find a way of meditating quite differently because it just seems to have got stuck, you know, or something like that. And you talk about that with somebody. Let them see you. Let them mirror you, if you like. Otherwise, you'll tend to choose the variety of spirituality that you just like. You go for it because you like it, but it may not actually touch some areas of your life. And then you need to look, I think, for objective results. Over the long term, you know, have I actually changed? Have I strengthened this particular quality? And that shows you you're taking concrete, methodical steps. And my own suggestion, very specific suggestion here, is to go on retreat. Because I think a retreat, whether it's a short one or a long one, is always lifting into a new arena at which it's much more likely that you'll notice what it is you really need to do with yourself. So get away on retreat if you possibly can. It tends to reveal the next step. And that might be very creative, very unexpected, what it is. So the Sangha is really on the path. In a sense, it's on the same path, in the sense that it's methodically bringing into being successively more skillful states. Not that they're all doing the same thing, by any means. An objective series of progressive, skillful mental states. There are, according to Buddhism at least, there are such things. You know, there are whatever your best at the moment, there is another best, which is lying just beyond that, which you can cultivate. And it has different names, this path. You know, in the Satipatthana Sutra, it's called the Path of Mindfulness. In the White Lotus Sutra, it's called the One Way, or the Buddha Way, and so on. But basically, there is that succession of states of mind, successive states of mind, which is the path. Happy is the unity of the Sangha. That's one way of looking at it. There are lots and lots of different formulations of it. Yeah, when I gave that quote from Dhammapada, happy is the unity of the Sangha. That word for unity is samaga. And samaga means with the same path. So unity means being on the same path. And I think it is a bit of an easy one to misunderstand because it doesn't mean that you all are doing the same things, that you're necessarily doing the same meditation practices, you're all completely agreeing with each other, but it means that you are engaged on that process of looking for the next step into increased skillfulness or increased presence of mind and so on. And then it says, when it says happy is the unity of the Sangha, it's saying happy is that samaga, that same pathedness of the Sangha. Happy is the spiritual practice of those on the same path. And so that leads very naturally onto the next word, which is harmoniously proceeding. I think in this one it says correctly proceeding, but a better translation, I think, is definitely harmonious. That's what it's implying. It literally means connected or in one, is what the word means. And we want to be connected, we want to unite with people. And I think this is a very deep need, in a sense, to sort of have the sense that you can share your experience with other people. It's an innate desire to unite. And it finds all sorts of expression, this sense of wanting to unite, wanting to make contact with people, I think. Sometimes in very self-oriented ways, we want to merge the other person in our own ego, we want to appropriate them to our own life. But in the Sangha, the expression of unity, of harmony there, is something that goes beyond your limited sense of self. And the unity of a Sangha is through bonds of friendship. So the harmony in the Sangha is because people do have personal friendships within it. You can't have personal make personal friends with everybody in the Sangha, not even everybody in the West London Buddhist Centre as a Sangha. But you do need, it seems to me, for it to work as a Sangha, you need some individual personal friendships with people. That's what really friendship is about. And that's those are the strands that hold the Sangha together, if that can happen. And you can't rush this, can you? You know, it's not something you can just make happen. But it's a good sign if you're starting to find that you're meeting up with people outside the context of the centre. They're becoming a part of your life just because you like them. You like being with them. They're starting to be your friends. Only friendships hold the Sangha together. It's not a group held together by a common leader or a common ideology. It's held together by genuine personal connections. At least that's my view. Samuel Johnson says, "Sir," he always starts off with "sir" in his quotes, "Sir, the emotion of friendship manifests in daily life as a readiness to sacrifice one's own pleasure and profit for the pleasure and profit of another, as a willingness to go where and to do what is agreeable to the other rather than to oneself." So that's the way, that's the mark of friendship, that's plus the way to make friends, is that sense of just their interests sometimes trumping yours, or even their needs trumping yours. So in the Sangha, one is independent, one is responsible for oneself, one's thinking for oneself, but yet you're prepared to let go of your narrow interests or your likes and dislikes because of the connections that you're making, it seems to me. And there will still be differences between people. Harmony doesn't mean everybody agrees with each other. And I think that's not only fine, it's actually important that there are those differences of approach and differences of priority. But those differences are not generating animosity. Harmony can still exist even though we don't completely agree with each other. We don't have the same perspective. Harmony can still be there. And in fact, I think that we are tempted to indulge in all sorts of antagonisms and animosity. It's just natural. That's what happens. We get irritated with people. We wish they were different. We can't see how they can't see that such and such is really important. But Charlotte Bronte, another quote, says, "Life appears to me too short to be spent in nursing animosity or registering wrongs." And it is just a waste of time, really, to do that, I think. I think we need to keep reminding ourselves of what we have in common, of what really matters to us, which transcend or trump those little differences that we have. And so this sense of harmony is something the Buddha often talks about to do with the Sangha. He really stresses it. And he says, "Live a binder together of the divided. Live as an encourager of friends, enjoying concord, impassioned for concord, delighting in concord, a speaker of words making for concord." And that word translated there as concord is samaga again, same pathedness, unity or harmony. He also says, "One thing when arising in the world arises for the welfare of the masses, for the happiness of the masses. What is that one thing? It's concord in the Sangha. When the Sangha is in concord, there are no arguments with one another, no abuse of one another, no ganging up on one another, no abandoning of one another. Then those with little confidence in the teaching become confident, while those already confident become even more so." So it's quite strong. It uses this word, impassioned for concord, impassioned for harmony. This is the Buddha himself. It's very difficult to achieve a unified Sangha that's really harmoniously proceeding. As you know, if we've been in this order, we know that from many, many experiences. But the Buddha did teach a method for achieving this harmony. And this method is something I've gone into in other talks here, which is the four means of unification. And the four means of unification are practices, successive practices, which will always tend towards greater harmony. And the first one of those is giving, is generosity, which we're going to come to later. The second one of those is kind speech, speaking with kindness to each other. The third one of those, and these get successively more difficult in a way, is beneficial activity, is actually living in ways and acting in ways that do bring genuine benefit to others. And then the fourth one of those can be translated as deep empathy, where you have that sense of being in the same boat together, very deeply in the same boat, and recognizing that, not just theoretically, but recognizing it deeply in your heart. So those four things, if you practice those, you will tend to achieve harmony in the Sangha. So that's the list of the characteristics, you know, of the ideal Sangha, of the Arya Sangha, but at least in potential of our Sangha, those things can be there. It's happily proceeding, it's uprightly proceeding, it's methodically proceeding, it's harmoniously proceeding. So these are the things to do to make Sangha work, is to look for the happiness, look for the ethicality and straightforwardness, look for the path, the methodical path, and to look for the harmony. So it's a very beautiful teaching, I think, at least. Now then, what then happens is the T. Ratanavandana mentions the Arya Sangha. It mentions the four pairs of individuals, the eight persons, which are these different types of people who have realization. And I'm not going to go into that from stream entrance upwards. And then it says, well, these people are worthy of worship. I think this is a slightly dodgy area, isn't it? Particularly if we start applying it to each other, you know, if we were worshipping each other. But maybe it's not such a bad idea, actually. And I quite like in India when you have the namaste, where you have the sense of actually holding your hands together in greeting of another person, or the bowing that will happen in Japan, for example. And maybe our formality is a bit lost there. So at least a sense of maybe you know, worship, after all, because we've got these Christian connotations, you think worship must mean deifying. It must mean putting somebody up on a pedestal and making it divine. But actually, apparently the root of worship, it's an old Anglo-Saxon word, and it comes from worth-ship, so hence his worship, the mayor. Mm. What it means is simply recognising the worth and worthiness of another person. And surely we can do that. It seems to me that's the thing we can do. Maybe we need a different word for it now, though. So really valuing each other, regarding each other as having worth. Having affection for one's friends then symbolises the devotion for the Buddha as well. So the devotion for the Buddha, in a way, emerges from the respect that we have for each other, rather than you having this big dichotomy where you have enormous respect perhaps for the statue on the shrine, but not very much respect for each other. And then the next one is, after worthy of worship, is worthy of offerings. And what that means is giving each other gifts. And again, I'm going to carry on applying this to us, not just to the noble Sangha, but to us. And I think that that is a great way of binding together the Sangha, is if there are genuine gifts of all sorts of things going back and forth between us. So, you know, people just bringing along some food to share for lunch has a very strong symbolic feeling, I think. The fact of maybe cooking something or preparing something that you know other people will appreciate and will eat. There's something immensely satisfying about that, I think. But maybe also personal gifts as well. So, I mean, it's nice, of course, if your gifts are helping the centre, if there are donations helping the centre. But I think that's one way of holding the Sangha together, of course, in a practical way. And in a way, people like myself and Yesha Bodhi rely partly on what people give here in order to be able to continue working here. So that's fantastic. But also I think there need to be more personal, individual gifts going between people, other kinds of generosity. And that doesn't have to be material things, of course. There are many things that can be given. And again, that's a whole talk in itself on the different kinds of dana. And generosity builds connections, it builds friendships, and the more generosity there is around, then the less people feel they have to look after number one. In a way, that's one of the big challenges, it seems to me, of life, is the feeling that one really needs to protect oneself, and you have to worry all the time about whether you'll be okay in the future. Now, if there's a very strong culture of generosity going on, then you don't, that worry will at least reduce to some extent, it seems to me. Now, how do you do that? You do it by looking out for other people who are worried in that sort of way and seeing if you can help them. So do it on that level, rather than saying, will anybody help me in the future? We'll say, well, can I help anybody in the present? And that's, that means that a sangha is being created in which there is a supportive, an informal supportive network. I think this is quite important. And then worthy of worship, worthy of offerings, worthy of hospitality. And this is looking after each other. Maybe sometimes going to stay with each other. You know, if you've got a place, a nice place out in the country somewhere, maybe sort of spending time there with other people, having acquaintances around for meals. Maybe you're not a wonderful cook. That's all right. You can go and get a ready meal from Marks and Spencer's. And even if they haven't invited you, you know, you don't have to wait for them to invite you. Just invite them. You know, don't think, well, you know, I'm always inviting people around. Enjoy visiting. Enjoy being visited. Go on outings together. In Cambridge Sangha, we used to have picnics down by the river quite often, where we play rugby with melons. And it's very enjoyable sort of thing to do. And then worthy of salutation. This goes a little bit back to formality, but the word here is anjali. And anjali is this gesture. That's the Buddhist word for this gesture, is anjali, the salutation with folded hands. Now, I'm not very formal myself. I don't like too much formality. And in fact, I had an email a couple of days ago from the Buddhist society that I go to at the University of London, for just a student society. And they said, we've just been to the Chinese temple, and they taught us the details of the bow. They said, and so they were saying this, you know, do you think we should always do this for all the teachers we have coming along? And I thought, oh, God, I don't want them bloody bowing to me. Sounds terrible, doesn't it? Anyway, so I tried to send them a diplomatic email about it. But I thought it's a shame if, you know, if that's the main thing that you get taught if you go to a Buddhist temple, is how to bow to the monks, really, isn't it? However, worthy of salutation, it does say this. And maybe it's better to be over self-conscious in greeting people than over casual. Perhaps that's true. At least recognizing, noticing people, paying attention to them, relating to them with mutual respect. Really acknowledge them.
Perhaps the bowels is really what you're talking about then.
Yes.
It is just a way of valuing that this is what the monks are doing.
And yes, that's right. Yes. Yes.
They've chosen to dedicate their lives. That part of their lives to other people.
Yes, and don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting that one shouldn't pay respect to ordained Buddhists. But, I mean, personally, I would feel quite uncomfortable if people were doing that here. So I quite like the informality of this order. Maybe it's one advantage of not being in robes and so on, is that it doesn't happen here. But I don't mean that that's a bad thing to do by any means. I'm not saying that at all. And a certain amount of formality, in a way, even with each other, maybe is quite nice. A certain amount of respectful greeting, of taking notice when somebody's turned up. And somebody who you don't know at all, you know, they are full of hidden depths. And to, in a way, be open to that possibility that here is a really magical, complex person with a vast history is wonderful, I think. Especially within the Sangha, where there is a recognition, there's some sort of common striving. So you show that you've actually seen a person, you've accepted them. And that at least is symbolised by the bow or the anjali gesture. And then it says, the Sangha is an unexcelled field of merit for the world. An unexcelled field of merit for the world. And this is the end of the description of the Sangha. You could also translate it as a garden of merit. So the Sangha is said to be a garden of merit. So what does that mean? It's a traditional Buddhist idea And the traditional Buddhist idea is that certain people bear the most fruit if you plant seeds in them by helping them out. So that's the idea, that people that have a big influence on the world, if you can help them, then in a way your help goes a long way, because you're making it possible for them to do more. So that's the sense of the Sangha, the Arya Sangha at least, or the ordained Sangha, as being a field of merit, or a garden of merit. But maybe we can again broaden that sense out a bit. The Sangha is the best garden for planting seeds of merit or seeds of beauty. It's a garden that we're beautifying by leading beautiful lives. It's one of my favourite metaphors for the Buddhist life and for the Sangha, is the sense of it being a garden. I used to be a gardener, I suppose, so that's why I think of that. And planting seeds and putting bulbs out and things is a wonderful thing to do. And it's a garden that anyone can visit, and they can also plant their own seeds in that garden, their own seeds of merit. And this word merit, what it means is positivity. It means the good. It means all the beneficial results of skillfulness. So planting seeds of merit means being skillful. Every time you're skillful, according to the Buddhist tradition, you're planting a seed. And that seed, you know, some seeds will come up very quickly, some of them will come up only after a long time. But if one can have that sense of confidence that by being skillful, by an act of kindness, for example, in a sense it is a seed that you've planted, and that seed will produce an increasingly beautiful garden. And not just a garden of yourself, but a garden in the sense of the garden of the Sangha as a whole. So the Sangha is an unexcelled garden of merit. And you don't build a garden with bricks and cement and concrete floors. You build it by planting the seeds of a huge variety of beautiful plants and arranging them harmoniously together. So this also, by saying it's an unexcelled field of merit, the best field of merit, in other words, the best garden, the Buddha is praising the Sangha very, very extremely in a way, saying it's one of the most precious things that exists. And there's one place where he says, it almost feels as if it's a spontaneous expression of his appreciation of the Sangha. He looks around him at the members of the Sangha gathered there, and he just says this. He says, "This assembly is free from idle chatter." He says, "It's established on pure heart wood. Such is this community, such is this assembly." This is the sort of assembly that is rare to see in the world. Such is this community, such is this assembly. This is the sort of assembly it would be worth travelling for miles and miles to see, carrying with you a packed lunch, he says. Which I guess is his way of saying a long way. A whole day's travel, you know, if you've got a packed lunch.
I wonder what packed lunch consisted of.
Yes. Yes, I don't know if they had sandwiches in those days. So the world needs the Sangha. And Sangharakshita's image for Sangha is a garden planted in the wilderness, where you know that your positive actions, which are very tender plants, you know they will survive in the Sangha. At least you hope they will. They're more likely to. And by all means, try and plant plants elsewhere as well. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But don't be too disappointed if they don't all thrive, they don't all flourish. Because the Sangha is precious, and the Sangha is also fragile. It could easily turn into something which is no longer a Sangha. And the way that would happen is because the reason that we collected together would no longer be a spiritual reason. We'd have some other reason for wanting to be together, so that we were no longer a Sangha. We were just a special interest group of some kind. Maybe it was for security or for self-interest or something. And so just before he died, the Buddha was obviously concerned about the survival of the Sangha. And he said, "I want to teach you some important principles to help ensure that the Sangha will continue to flourish. Please remember these." And he started off with seven things, seven conditions. And this is what they were. They're quite interesting. He said, "Meet together regularly in large numbers." meet together regularly in large numbers. Then he said, meet, communicate, and part in harmony. In other words, try and be in harmony when you arrive, try and communicate harmoniously together when you're together, and try and make sure you're still in harmony when you part. Then he said, keep to the traditions of the Sangha. And we could debate exactly what those were, but that's interesting. He said, keep to the traditions of the Sangha. And then he said, look after the elders of the Sangha and consider that they are worth paying attention to. And then he said, don't fall prey to craving, which leads to rebirth. Don't fall prey to craving, in other words, that keeps you going round in circles on the wheel of life. That's a danger, he said, to the continuance of the Sangha. And then he said, be devoted to wild places suitable for meditation. So, you know, as well as stressing the value of coming together, he also is stressing, this is a bit paradoxical, isn't it? For the value of the Sangha, don't forget your solitude. Don't forget your meditation practice. Don't forget being in the wild for your meditation. That was number six. Number seven, preserve personal mindfulness so that in the future, the good among your companions will come to you and those who've already come to you will feel at ease with you. Preserve a personal mindfulness so that the good among your companions will come to you and those who've already come to you will feel at ease with you. So you could, I mean, the whole talk you could give about those seven, couldn't you? They're very, very interesting. I often find this with what the Buddha says. It's not necessarily what you'd expect, but he's got a very deep sense of what it is that makes the Sangha work, and he mentions those in particular. So the growing Sangha, the growing and thriving garden, is, according to the Tirunavandana, worthy of worship, worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, and worthy of, let's say, greetings. And we've seen that the word Sangha can mean those with some degree of enlightenment, the noble Sangha. It can also mean those who've been fully accepted into a particular order, the Sangha of the ordained. And it can also mean the greater Sangha, all those who are genuinely striving to improve their lives and the world around them as well. And such as perhaps the Sangha here at the West London Buddhist Centre. And strictly, when a Buddhist goes for refuge, it's strictly to the noble Sangha. It's the noble Sangha because that's the only one that is reliable. And it's reliable because it consists only of people who have some direct access to the way things actually hang together, the way things actually are. And anyone who doesn't have that access can't really be relied on, in a sense. Because they, or we, I should say, are subject to all sorts of fears and needs and things like that that tend to blink at our view of the world. So that's the difference. That's the idea of the Arya Sangha, the noble Sangha. But I think we can treat each other as if we were noble, and that's one of the best ways to be noble. Treat each other nobly, as if we were part of the noble Sangha. And we can use the teachings of the Salutation to the Three Jewels to discover how to live as if we were a noble Sangha. So we're hearers of the voice of enlightenment, and the Salutation to the Sangha says that this is what the hearers of the voice of enlightenment are like. They follow these epithets. We walk along happily. We walk along uprightly. We walk along step by step, methodically. We walk along harmoniously. And because we're proceeding in this way, we can give each other worship and gifts and hospitality and greetings. And we're contributing to an unexcelled garden of merit for the world. And then there's an ending for the whole poem, which goes like this. To all the Sanghas of the past, to all the Sanghas yet to be, to all the Sanghas that now are, my worship flows unceasingly. No other refuge than the Sangha, refuge supreme is there for me. Oh, by virtue of this truth, may auspiciousness and victory come to me. So this is going for refuge, the special Buddhist term that means commitment or giving priority to something, taking something very, very seriously, looking to something for one's real security in a way. And the best way of going for refuge to the Sangha is to combine with other people to create Sangha. We create Sangha by the way we communicate, by staying in contact with each other, I think. And that's what we're going to explore for the rest of this day, which is Sangha Day.